Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we bring you a selection from EQMM's Passport to Crime Department, a tale of psychological suspense by Hilde van der Meeren, a Belgian writer who has won awards for her many books for children and also for her adult crime novels. Before turning to fiction writing full-time, the author was a practicing psychologist, and this story, entitled The Lighthouse and published in EQMM's March-April 2016 issue, makes good use of that background. The story is read for our series by its translator, Josh Pachter, someone who is also a frequent contributor of fiction to EQMM.
Paul Casteur watched the motorboat putter back out to sea. The north wind tore at his hair and made him shiver. Threatening clouds loomed overhead. Angry waves dashed onto the island's rocky shoreline, chewed at it like rats ravaging a dead body. The lighthouse door was open a crack, and from inside came the sound of Monique opening and shutting kitchen cabinets. He supposed she was putting away the provisions they'd brought, each item in its proper place. Canned goods and bottles with their labels facing forward, precisely spaced so that no two items touched. When she was finished, she'd climb the stairs and organize the bathroom, make certain the tub was ring-free, no hair left behind, then continue to the third floor and plump the pillows on the bed. Perhaps, if she had time, she'd fix them an aperitif and carry it up to the lantern room, from which, according to the motorboat's pilot, they'd enjoy the magnificent view. The magnificent view of what? Paul wondered. The island was minuscule, the lighthouse its only structure. A unique tourist attraction, Monique had promised him. The motorboat disappeared into the distance. It would be back to pick them up in 3 days, or was it four? Paul swept his gaze from left to right, tracing the horizon. He listened to the pounding of the waves and had the odd sense that the island had grown even smaller. The first raindrops began to fall. They traced a chilly trail down his cheeks and dripped from his beard to the dirt path that led from the shoreline to the lighthouse door. He turned away from the rain and went inside. His muscles ached with every step. Perhaps he should have stayed a few more days in the hospital. A younger body would have healed more quickly from the trauma of the accident. But Dr. Franke had given him permission to make this journey. Monique had pressed him to agree. Paul had overheard the two of them discussing his condition in the corridor outside his room. At first, the doctor had thought it was too soon for him to travel, but Monique had managed to convince him. He pulled the door shut. Right in front of him, blocking his view of the living room and kitchen, a steep flight of stairs climbed to the upper floors. He wondered why Monique hadn't suggested a one-level bed and breakfast somewhere on the mainland. In the tiny living room, he dropped onto a well-worn sofa by the wood stove. It would take a while before the fire melted the ice from his bones. His hands shivered. He was thirsty. Where was Monique? He struggled to his feet and stepped into the kitchenette. He opened the small refrigerator, and then, one by one, each of the cabinets. He found bottled water, milk, and orange juice, but nothing to take off the chill. He closed the last cabinet door. Behind him, he heard Monique coming down the stairs. "No whiskey?" he asked. She shook her head. "Beer? Wine?" She shook off each of his questions. Sometimes he asked himself what had drawn him to Monique in the first place. They'd been together for so long now, he couldn't remember exactly how it had begun between them. He looked at her. She had short brown hair. For a woman of her age, she was still quite attractive. He could thank her aesthetic lifestyle for that. She was uninclined to take in alcohol or give out either money or sex. He wasn't sure which of those characteristics annoyed him the most. Was it her reluctance to grant him a glass of good wine at the end of a hard day at the store? Or the fact that she insisted on their driving the same old car year after year? Or the depressing reality that their bedroom had long since become the coldest room in the house? "Hungry?" she asked. He nodded. This was a lie. He was thirsty, not hungry. She poured him a glass of water and handed him three magazines she slid from a plastic shopping bag. He examined them. One was devoted to gardening, one to soccer. The third was aimed at active seniors. He dropped them onto the coffee table. Monique paid no attention. She was opening a can of white beans and tomato sauce. What the hell, Paul thought, is she up to? He didn't like white beans and tomato sauce. She knew that. Soccer bored him. The jewelry shop had kept him far too busy to spare time for gardening. And although the accident had left him weakened, he was still a long way from turning 65. Outside, the rain beat against the lighthouse's small round windows. He sank onto the sofa and reached for Senior Life. Pretending to page through it, he kept an eye on Monique. The fussy way she measured out a pat of butter and placed it exactly in the center of the frying pan stoked his irritation. He stopped at a photograph of an older couple and their four grandchildren, all of them on bicycles out in some anonymous forest. He wanted to tear it out of the magazine and shred it. He felt like Monique was rubbing his face in a future they would never be able to enjoy. They had had no children, so no one would ever call them Grandpa and Grandma. There was a caption beneath the photo, but the print was too small for him to read. "Have you seen my glasses?" he asked her. "On the table, just inside the front door," she said, not looking up from her work. "You put them there when you came in." He got up. He couldn't have left his glasses on a table. He wore them on a little chain around his neck. He'd begun doing that when he first took over the management of the jewelry store and retained the habit even after he'd sold the business last year. His glasses were on the table just inside the front door. No chain. He put them on and returned to the living room. Monique had her back to him, silent as always. The butter in the pan began to sizzle. He looked out the window. The waves were breaking closer to the lighthouse now, making the little island even smaller. Maybe it all had something to do with the store. Monique had been acting strangely ever since he'd sold it. The phone calls that ended abruptly the moment he came into the room. Envelopes that arrived in the mail but disappeared before he had a chance to open them. The arguments over what they should do with the money he'd gotten for the store and its stock. He wanted to travel, lay down a cellar of fine wine, keep an eye out for a summer home somewhere down south. She had rejected each of his proposals out of hand. And then there'd been the accident. A semi had run him off the highway. When he'd regained consciousness in the hospital, the police told him that the truck driver had fallen asleep behind the wheel. Monique emptied the can of beans and red sauce into the pan. He shuddered. Perhaps this was her way of telling him she didn't love him anymore. Easier to serve him food he didn't like than serve the truth straight to his face. "I'm going to the bathroom," he said. She asked if he needed her help, but he waved the offer away. Step by step, he struggled up the stairs. His forehead was beaded with sweat by the time he reached the second floor. Monique had misinformed him. Whether mistakenly or on purpose, he had no idea. The bathroom was on the third floor, the bedroom on the second. He would have to climb another flight. He was dizzy and paused to catch his breath. He dropped onto the edge of the bed. Monique had left her purse on the floor. Without thinking, he reached for it and unclasped it. Her cell phone was powered down. There was no point leaving it on. There would be no signal this far out. He opened her wallet and found a wad of cash. That was surprising. Their lodgings and the boat transfers, she'd said, had been paid in advance. He flipped through the wallet's contents. business cards, tickets, driver's license, passport, nothing special. She called up from downstairs. Was he all right? Be right down, he shouted. There was one last compartment in the wallet. His fingers trembled as he explored it. Inside, he found a faded snapshot. A child, maybe 4 years old. A little girl with two blonde pigtails. He had no idea who she was. Why was Monique carrying a photograph of a stranger? He heard her footsteps on the stairs. He shoved the picture back in its place, stuffed the wallet in the purse, and tossed it under the bed. Just in time. I thought the bathroom was on this floor, he said. She shook her head. One flight up, she told him. She insisted on helping him up the stairs. Her fingers squeezed his arm tightly as she guided him. It aggravated him that she stood outside the bathroom door while he peed, more so when she zipped his fly for him as if he were a toddler. Since the accident, he'd had trouble with zippers. You need to be careful, she said, on their way downstairs. If you fall, we can't call for help. They had dinner in silence. Outside, the storm rattled the windows in their frames. Two more nights after this. Or was it three? He didn't touch the beans. What Monique had said to him on the stairs, had that been a warning? He would have to keep his wits about him. The nurse had forgotten to close the curtains. That was Paul's first thought. But when he opened his eyes, he didn't recognize the room. The windows were round, the white hospital walls a dull terracotta. He got up and went to the window and saw sunlight glittering on an endless blanket of sea. He turned. The woman in the bed sat up. Her name was Monique. They were married. And there was something else. Something had happened the day before, and a warning light was blinking inside his head. But he couldn't remember what the light was warning him against. Did you sleep all right? She asked. He nodded. There was an open laptop on a desk against the wall. He pulled the wooden chair away from the desk and perched on it, and his fingers fitted into the curve of the laptop's keyboard with an ease that surprised him. It was as if he'd sat here before, at this very spot, at this desk, in this chair, with its view of the slate-gray sea. He jerked his hands from the keys as if they had burned his fingertips. Something wrong, she said. Her voice seemed strange. She eyed him as if she were waiting for something to happen. I'm thirsty, he said. That was clearly not the response she had hoped for. He could tell by the slump of her shoulders. I'll make coffee, she said. She got out of the bed, and a book fell to the floor. He scooted the chair back and reached for it, but Monique got there first. She snatched up the book, clutched it to her breast, and went downstairs. He gazed out the window. Monique had changed since the accident. He closed his eyes. His hands gripped the steering wheel. He was driving along the highway, enveloped by the night. There was little traffic, and he swung around a semi with a foreign license plate. The high-mast light poles were beacons guiding him homeward. He wanted to get there as quickly as he could. Monique would be expecting him. He checked the speedometer and eased up on the gas. She would never forgive him for driving unsafely. He would never forgive himself for putting the gems in the attaché case on the back seat at risk. He would get off at the next exit, and after that it would only be 15 more minutes to the house. He slipped a CD into the changer, and soft jazz filled the car. The semi he had passed a minute earlier reappeared in his rearview mirror. It was gaining on him. He saw it sway across the center line and back. After the crash, everything was dead silent. Silent and empty, darker than night. Paul opened his eyes. There was a laptop on the desk before him. The lighthouse. Those two words flickered on the screen. He was unaware of having typed them. The story he had always wanted to write when he retired blossomed in his mind. All at once, there it was. He rubbed his eyes. Monique came into the bedroom with a tray. The smell of fresh coffee came with her. She set a cup and saucer on the desk. Black, 2 sugar cubes in the saucer. "No milk?" he asked. "You take it black, Paul." He closed the lid of the laptop, hiding the words he had typed. "Are you writing?" she asked. He nodded. She smiled. "It's all going to be okay," she said. "Would you like some toast?" "I'm not hungry," he said. "Should I help you get dressed? Do you need to use the bathroom?" "I want to write a little first." She got clean clothes for herself from the closet and went upstairs. He waited until she was gone. Then he reopened the laptop. The sentences came more slowly than he had hoped. His fingers were shaking, and he made frequent mistakes. More than once, he found himself unable to remember a word he wanted. He raised the cup to his lips. Black coffee. Why hadn't she put milk in it, the way he always drank it? He returned it to the saucer without tasting it, examined the dark liquid suspiciously. Could she have put something in the coffee? Something that wouldn't have the desired effect if there was also milk in the cup? Something to send him back to sleep, so she could do whatever she liked without his interference? Maybe something she'd read about in that book she'd tried to hide from him? He had to get a look at that book. Perhaps there was something in the coffee that would give him a heart attack and leave no trace. Died peacefully in his sleep, the coroner would say. He pushed the saucer away, and a black wave slopped over the rim of the cup. She was up to something. He could feel it. The silences, the questions she asked him. They kept coming back to money. Money she didn't want him to spend. Monique had never worked a day in her life. He'd always made enough from the jewelry store to support them. If he were out of the picture, everything would be hers. He had to go downstairs and find that book. Was she still in the bathroom? He had no idea. Perhaps she'd slipped past the bedroom door without him noticing. He got up, grabbed the back of the chair to stop himself from falling. She'd picked the right time to act. He was still weak from the accident. That's why Dr. Franke hadn't wanted him to travel. But he was well enough to stay one step ahead of Monique. The wooden steps creaked as he descended. The kitchen was empty. The only sounds were the bubbling of the coffee maker and the susurrus of the sea outside. There was a cutting board on the counter, a knife, an assortment of vegetables she had begun to slice for soup. Carrots, leeks, onions, celery. There were magazines on the coffee table in the living room. He picked one up, Senior Life. A page had been torn out of it. He found a trash basket against the room's curved wall. At the bottom was a balled-up piece of paper. He plucked it free and smoothed it out on the kitchen counter. It was the page that had been torn from the magazine. The article was about estate taxes. He could feel his heart race. His head began to throb. His suspicions were confirmed. Monique was after his money, the money he'd gotten for the sale of the store his father had left him. He heard her coming down the stairs. She was humming. He stood there, shaking in his boots, his body a wreck, while she cheerfully planned to do away with him. She was wearing a bathrobe. Her hair was wet. She stopped humming. "What are you doing?" she asked, staring at his hands. He looked down. He was holding a knife. She dropped the towel she was carrying and put a hand to her throat as if protecting herself. She took a step away from him and bumped into the wall. "Is there something I ought to know?" he asked, holding out the crumpled magazine page in his free hand. "Something about estate taxes?" She shook her head, mute. He stepped closer. There was no way for her to escape. He raised the knife. "You didn't just happen to pick this place, did you, Monique?" A tear formed at the corner of her eye. "Dr. Franck has said it was a bad idea," she whispered. "He was afraid it would be too much of a shock, but I thought it might help you."
"What might help me?"
"Coming here. I thought it might be good for you. I thought you might be able to write here, like before."
"Before?"
"Before the accident. You wrote the first chapters of your book here."
"What are you talking about? I never wrote a book."
"You did, Paul."
"Why are you lying to me?"
"I'm not lying. Please, put the knife down."
He tightened his grip. His hand was shaking violently. "I'm a jeweler," he said, "not a writer."
There was an urgency in his voice, almost a plea. "I wear my glasses on a chain around my neck."
She shook her head.
"That was your father," she said softly. "Your father was a jeweler. You were a writer until the accident."
He wished she would stop telling lies, but she went on talking, gently, insistently. "He'd stopped writing," she said. "They never had much money after that because she was the only one of them able to work. And the accident had happened 30 years ago, not recently. Ever since, he'd refused to leave the house. All he did was sit at home and drink, trying to forget. It was the drinking that had destroyed his health, until at last Dr. Franca had sent him off to rehab." "Forget what?" he demanded. "What was I trying to forget?"
Her face was white and drawn with fear. "I want you to put the knife down, Paul."
"What was I trying to forget?" he shouted.
"Who was in the car with you when the truck hit you?" said Monique.
"I was alone in the car," he spat.
The point of the knife was only inches from her face. "Our daughter," she whispered. "She had just turned 4. She was spending the weekend with my parents, but she came down with something, and you went to get her and bring her home."
"You're lying," he said. "We never had a daughter."
"Her name was Ruby," she said, "our little gem. She was in her car seat in the back of the car. She's what you've been trying to forget all these years."
She was trying to upset him, and it was working. His headache was much worse. He felt sick to his stomach. He screamed at her to shut her mouth, but she kept on talking, and his vision suddenly blurred. He awoke in a strange bed. The room was cold and empty. He had no idea where he was. He got up slowly. His pajamas were filthy. Where was the woman who looked after him? Monique. They were married. He called her name. No response. Outside, the wind wailed. Or perhaps it wasn't the wind. It was an odd noise, a whooshing sound that repeated itself over and over. There was a laptop on a desk against one wall of the bedroom. He stumbled across the floor to it and dropped into the chair. A sheet of paper lay next to the laptop. It looked like it had been torn out of a magazine, something about estate taxes. On the other side of the page was an article about Korsakoff syndrome. Neurological disorder, retrograde amnesia, confabulation, commonly associated with alcoholism. He didn't bother to read the rest of it. There were flecks of red on the page. They reminded him of white beans and tomato sauce, his favorite dish. He would ask Monique to make it for their supper tonight. He crumpled the page and threw it away. His hands were trembling. The laptop was powered down. He couldn't remember how to turn it on. He got up and looked around the room. The walls were curved. He was trapped in a round cell with little round windows. Or, no, not trapped. There was a door and flights of stairs leading up and down. He called Monique's name as he went clumsily down the steps. There was a living room and a little kitchen at the bottom. There were vegetables on a cutting board on the kitchen counter. They were shriveled and dry and appeared to have been sitting there for quite some time. It was cold. The wood stove had gone out. He shivered. He found a book beneath the sofa cushion, as if someone had tried to hide it. The Lighthouse by Paul Kasteur. On the back cover was a photograph of a man he didn't recognize, a young man, 30 years younger than himself. He dropped the book onto the coffee table. Only then did he notice the carmine splatter on the living room's terracotta walls. His muscles protesting, he eased himself onto the couch. In the distance, he could make out the low rumble of an approaching car over the steady background, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. No, not a car. It sounded like the engine of a motorboat.
The Lighthouse is copyrighted by Hilde van der Meeren. Music for the podcast is from Schubert's Piano Sonata in A Minor and was obtained from MuseOpen.org and the Community Audio section of the Internet Archive. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.